perfume and the lacy outline of her bra long before she leaned down to kiss me. So how could it be her fault? I'm starting to think that I have always been an awful person, and the town of Buckley merely shone a light on it. The drive to Austin had gone by in a whirl of noise and nausea, and as I got closer to town, I realized that I wasn't ready to confess to my mother that her golden boy was a fraud, that I'd been kicked out of my apartment because of my epic failure as a human being. I couldn't face that. And then I remembered a little trail where I used to take girls back when I was in high school, a long field approach surrounded by trees where we could make out undisturbed. I drove there and parked between two enormous cottonwoods, their thick leaves stirring the air above me. The field approach is, as I remember it, dark, secluded, a good place to spend the night. Now, as I lay on the hood of my car, I feel more alone than I have ever felt before. I have my car and the clothes on my back, and that is all. I have no home. I am moored to nothing. The chirps and trills of the night critters fill the air around me, seemingly undisturbed by my presence. To drown them out, and to avoid dwelling on my sins, I think back to the first moment when I knew that I loved Lila. I always expected such a moment to come with confetti and music, but for me, it came in candlelight. We hadn't yet moved in together, and the three of us had planned an evening of watching television and eating popcorn. It was April, and a spring storm came through, knocking out the power. With no TV, a bored Jeremy went to bed early, so Lila and I snuggled up on the couch and talked. Our conversation that night touched on nothing profound. She told me about her favorite Christmas. She got a puppy, named Annie. She told me about a day when she was 8 years old and was plucked from the audience and put on stage at a Shania Twain concert. She told me about visiting her aunt at work, a paralegal at a law firm, and how that lit the fire that would send her to law school. For my part, I confessed to her how I often felt like a fraud. I was never the kind of guy who was meant to make a living without dirt under my fingernails. I told her how I felt like I didn't belong in school, and that I was sure someone would figure it out and send me back to Austin. That's when she rolled onto my chest, her beautiful face brimming with sincerity. She told me that I was wrong, that I wasn't a fake. She called me amazing and ingenious, and as I listened to her, I began to believe it. I honestly never thought that I would become a journalist until that night when I saw it in her eyes. And I loved her for that. She fell asleep before I did, and I remember looking at her soft face and thinking that I would never want for anything more from life than to be with her. I shift my position on the hood of my car, and the pain in my chest flares to remind me of where I am and what I've done. I want the memory of Lila back. I want it all back. I remain on my hood for hours, staring up at the stars and remembering, until sleep finally comes to ease the pain. Chapter 39. I wake up the next morning, still reclined on my windshield, my clothes damp with sweat and dew, my mind pulled from sleep by the call of a mourning dove. I move, and the pain in my ribcage comes alive. I feel like a rusted hinge as I make my way off the hood of my car and into the driver's seat. I check my phone, knowing that she would not have called me or sent a text. And I am right. I drive 10 minutes to Kathy's place, pausing before knocking on her door. I've never knocked on this door before. This had been my home for more years than not, but it's not my home any longer. Right as my knuckles tap wood, I hear my mother's voice coming from inside.
I can't believe it. Jeremy, what am I going to do with you?
Not waiting for an invitation, I open the door and step into the apartment. But I don't find what I had expected. No argument. No backslide on Kathy's recovery. Instead, I see my mother and my brother playing cards. Kathy smiles at me, and Jeremy looks my way but then goes back to the game, his eyes studying his cards.
How's it going? I ask.
Terrible. Mom says with a melodramatic flair. Jeremy keeps beating me at Go Fish. He's a real card shark. He's won every game so far.
She's letting him win. Another small change in our mother. I remember when she used to say that letting a child win a game doesn't teach them anything.
It's a hard world out there, she would say. The sooner you understand that, the better.
It's such a small thing to let Jeremy win at a game.
but it is so much at odds with the mother I've known my whole life that I can barely reconcile what I'm seeing.
I made muffins,
she says, pointing to a plate on the counter covered with a towel.
I didn't make coffee. I don't drink it anymore, but I have some if you want to make it.
You don't drink coffee?
That stuff can be addictive.
She shrugs and gives me a smile.
In for a penny, in for a pound.
I grab two muffins, pour a glass of milk, and take a seat at the table.
How do you like staying here?
I ask Jeremy. I suspect that Kathy knows that my question isn't just making small talk. I want a report on our mother's parenting skills as well as Jeremy's comfort level, at least to the extent that he can make such a report.
Maybe I like my bed, he says.
That tells me all I need to know.
Mom asks, are you taking Jeremy home today?
In her voice, I can sense a hint of sadness.
No, I say, not yet.
I am not ready to tell my mother that I've been thrown out of my apartment. In fact, I was wondering if Jeremy could stay here another day or two. I calculate in my head. Bar exam starts tomorrow. It's a 2-day test. After that, I'll find out where things stand between Lila and me. My chest starts to hurt just thinking about it.
I'd love that,
Mom says.
Jeremy, would that be okay with you?
I ask.
Yes. Do you have any eights?
He asks Kathy.
Well, doggone it, you got me again.
Kathy pulls an eight from her hand and gives it to Jeremy, who lays down a pair. Kathy gives an exaggerated sigh, and Jeremy laughs. As Jeremy is contemplating his next request, Kathy asks me,
are you going back to Buckley then?
I'm not sure, I say. I might go up to Mankato.
What's in Mankato?
Oh, I didn't tell you. I have a sister. Kathy looks perplexed at that statement. Toke married a woman in Buckley named Jeannie Hicks. They had a daughter. Her name is Angel, so that makes her my half-sister. Kathy is shaking her head no as she processes the information. I feel bad for blurting it out the way I did. I didn't stop to remember how Toke treated her when she got pregnant.
No, he can't. That's not possible.
Kathy looks at me with an expression of utter confusion. I've met her, I say.
Jeremy, can we take a break from cards for a little bit?
Jeremy nods his head.
Maybe I can go watch TV.
Would you, honey? I want to talk to Joe for a second.
After Jeremy leaves the table, Kathy goes to her bedroom and returns with a box. I'd seen that box in her closet going back to my earliest memories, but I never looked inside because it had a lock on it. Kathy opens it by prying the latch sideways with a butter knife. She digs through it, pulling out a few pictures and handing them to me before going back to her search. I recognize my mother in one of the pictures, young and attractive, sitting on a lawn chair with a man who I now know is my father. They are holding up Budweiser cans as if toasting the person taking the picture. In another snapshot, he's standing with one arm draped across her shoulders, and she's got both of her arms wrapped around his waist.
Your father wasn't always a jerk to me. As you can see, there was a time when I'd say we were happy. But after I got pregnant, he became spiteful and cruel.
I found the police report from when he hit you in the stomach. I say. Kathy pauses as that memory washes over her, and I can see her embarrassment in the way she presses her lips together and drops her gaze.
I guess you could say that was the night we broke up. I sometimes saw him around town after you were born. I actually thought that he might change his mind about you if he saw you.
That's why you gave me his name? She nods.
I'm sorry about that. It was a stupid thing to do. If anything, it backfired. It made him crazy mad. And then one night, when you were only a few months old, I got a letter from Joe. He was furious because the county was going after him for child support. They were going to garnish his wages. He wrote some very hateful things in that letter. One of the things he said was that the child support thing made him so mad that he went and got a vasectomy. He said that he did it so that no damn bitch could ever try to trap him into marriage again.
Mom pauses to take a breath, and I can see a slight tremble in her fingers.
That was Joe's goodbye letter. He said he was leaving Minnesota. I never heard from him again.
Jesus, what a jerk.
Yeah. So you see, Joe can't have a daughter.
Well,
Even if he was telling the truth about the vasectomy, those things can be undone, can't they?
Probably. But Joe hated the very thought of children. Here.
Kathy digs through the box again and pulls out another letter, handing it to me.
What's this? I ask.
Joe wrote that when he was in jail after they arrested him for punching me. If you want it, you can have it. It's the closest you'll ever have to your father saying goodbye. But there's nothing nice about this letter. You don't have to read it if you don't want to.
I unfold the letter. Scratchy, cursive text on white paper.
Kathy, you are such a bitch. Did you really think it would work? Did you really think I would stay with you? Well, the joke's on you. I'm not having anything to do with any kid. You will have to make do with the bed you made. And don't think I'm going to pay you any child support, neither. You try that shit and I'll quit my job and be gone. You'll never find me. You ain't getting a dime from me. I'll live in the woods and eat berries before I pay you anything. I guess your little game didn't have the outcome you wanted. Go to hell and take the kid with you. Fuck you, Joe.
I finish reading the letter and look up to see my mother staring at the table between us. I try to say something to lighten the mood. He writes like a fifth grader, I say. It's a good thing he left. That makes my mother smile. Chapter 40. If Mom is right about Toke's vasectomy, then Kimball's investigation is being steered by a blind man. This could be nothing, but then again, it could be huge. Despite my trepidation about returning to Buckley, I want to deliver this news to Sheriff Kimball personally. I want to watch his face as it sinks in, see if it hits him the way it hit me. If there had been a vasectomy, they can prove it with a second autopsy. Angel can only be Toke's daughter if Toke had the procedure reversed, and from everything that I'd learned about my father, he doesn't seem like a man who would be willing to go to that length to be a father. But then again, who knows what he might have done to get his hands on the Hicks estate? As I pull into town, another thought strikes me, and I take a turn that leads me to Bob Mullen's office. When I enter, I find Bob sharply focused on something on his computer. I knock on the wall to get his attention, and he looks up at me, lines of worry tracing across his forehead.
They charged Moody Lynch with murder, he says.
They what? How?
Second-degree murder.
Bob waves me into his inner office. That's impossible. They don't have enough to charge him, do they?
They do, and you're the key witness.
Bob hands me a document. A criminal complaint. And I begin reading about how they believe that Moody Lynch killed Toke Talbert. They state, Moody Lynch informed a witness, Joe Talbert Jr., that he, defendant, had an encounter with Joe, Toke, Talbert Sr., during which the defendant struck the senior Mr. Talbert in the head with a metal gear. They left out where I said it was self-defense. Toke attacked Moody with a rope and beat the crap out of him. Where's that part? And Toke was alive when Moody left. Hell, Moody was the one who called the cops.
Is it true that he hit Toke with a gear?
He said he grabbed it off the wall when Toke was hitting him. He wasn't trying to kill Toke.
Your statement is evidence, Bob says. They can spin it any way they want to. Just like I'll be spinning it the opposite way.
You're representing Moody?
His family just left. I'll be his attorney.
I don't believe Moody killed Toke.
That's admirable, Joe, but belief isn't evidence.
You can get the evidence, I say. You're his attorney, so you can get all the reports and tapes and stuff, right?
Yes, I'll get all that in time.
How much time?
What? Oh, I guess they'll hand most of the discovery to me at the first appearance tomorrow.
Why? Can you get it today?
What are you driving at?
I have information that might help clear Moody. Can you get the discovery today?
If I have a good reason.
Bob points at a chair and I sit down.
You want to tell me what you're talking about?
I know something that the sheriff doesn't. I just came from my mother's house in Austin. We were talking about Toke, and I mentioned that I have a half-sister, and I stop before I get too far ahead of myself and collect my thoughts, asking the question that I came there to ask.
Mr. Mullen, is it possible that Jeannie Talbert had an affair?
Bob pulls back as if some foul scent just brushed his nose.
Affair?
She worked here.
You were close to her.
Jeannie was like a daughter to me. Which is just one reason in a long list of reasons why this conversation is highly inappropriate.
Before he left Austin, Toke told my mother that he had a vasectomy. He was rubbing my mother's nose in it.
Those things can be reversed, Bob says.
He treated Angel like he resented her. Bob raises his eyebrows at that one.
Like a child he knows isn't his own.
Exactly. If Jeannie had an affair, that would explain a lot. She worked for you. You had to see something. Bob tugs at his beard, either concentrating on a memory or deciding whether to tell me what he knows. I can't tell which. Then he leans forward, his elbows on the desk, his hands clasped together, his face sad.
I think there might have been someone.
He says,
she never told me, and I never asked, but now that I think about it, I guess it might have been around the time she got pregnant. Toke was hitting the sauce pretty hard, I remember that. She would come to work with bags under her eyes. Her concentration was off. She'd only been working for me for a little while, so I didn't pry, although I wish I had. She seemed quite sad for a long time. But then she made this swing, a complete 180, happy and cheerful. I even catch her singing songs at her desk. She had a pretty voice. I just figured that she'd resolved whatever had been bothering her.
She was having an affair?
It's possible. There was this one night that Toke showed up at my home looking for Jeannie. I got the impression that he thought she was still at the office. I hemmed and hawed until he let the cat out of the bag. He said that Jeannie told him that she was working late, but the office was already closed for the day. I kept my response simple and evasive, telling him that she had been working a lot lately. I told him that I had gone home early because of a headache, and that I didn't know when Jeannie left. That wasn't true. Jeannie left early that day.
Did Toke figure it out?
I don't know. Like I said, I didn't pry. When Jeannie came in the next morning, I told her about Toke's visit. She didn't react one way or another to that news, but after that, she went back to being the old Jeannie, the one who didn't sing at her desk.
She ended her affair.
That'd be a reasonable conclusion.
Do you have any idea who the affair was with?
No, but I might be able to figure it out. I have a program on my phones to record the number for all outgoing calls, even local ones. I use it to bill clients accurately. I never throw those records away in case anyone wants to dispute my bill. I'm kind of a pack rat that way.
Bob stands and walks to a small door just outside of his office, disappearing down a staircase into the basement. I wait, listening to the clock on the wall tick away the minutes, 12 of them in all, before he returns. In his hand, he carries a yellow folder, and he is reading from the pages of that folder as he sits down.
These are calls made from Jeannie's phone 9 months before Angel was born.
He studies the page, and I watch as a glimmer of recognition grows on his face.
There's one number here. She was talking to this person multiple times a day and for 20 and 30 minutes at a shot. I had no idea.
Who is it?
I don't recognize the number, but we can call it and find out.
Use *67 so they can't see who's calling.
Good idea.
Bob hits the speaker button on his desk phone and dials. We look at each other as it rings once, twice, then click.
Jeb Lewis here.
Bob hangs up. Chapter 41. After we put together a plan, Bob and I leave his office together, heading toward the courthouse square. I break away as we pass the sheriff's office, and Bob continues on, limping his way up the granite steps of the courthouse to see the county attorney. His part of our plan is to sit in that office until they give him the evidence in Moody's case. I walk into the sheriff's office and ask to see Kimball. At first, the receptionist tells me that he's too busy to see me. Tell Sheriff Kimball that I have new evidence that he needs to know about. Tell him that I have proof that his investigation is tainted. He needs to see me. She rolls her eyes, picks up the phone, and speaks a few words, her irritated expression never softening. A minute later, Sheriff Kimball appears at the door.
This had better be good. I'm busy.
Is there some place we can talk in private? Kimball looks disgusted and shakes his head, but leads me to the conference room.
Now, what's this all about?
He says. I look at the camera in the corner of the ceiling. Is Jeb listening?
No. Jeb's out on a call, so you'll have to talk to me.
You're the one I want to talk to. I think you arrested the wrong man.
Oh, for Christ's sake.
Just hear me out, I say. I know you and Nathan don't want to believe a word that Moody Lynch says.
Is that what this is about?
Kimball stands up and starts for the door.
You're wasting my time.
No, that's not what this is about. I raise my hands in a stay-put gesture. I have new information, and it explains some of the problems in Moody's statement. Kimball crosses his arms and stands by the door.
Fine, let's hear it.
Moody said that when he got to the barn, he found Angel on the ground. Groggy, like she'd already taken the pills. But Jeb said that he found her in the house. That doesn't make sense, so naturally you assume that Moody was lying about seeing Angel there.
Of course he was lying. She was unconscious when Jeb found her in her bed.
But what if Jeb is the one who is lying? Kimball's demeanor drops from irritated to threatening.
Boy, you had better tread lightly.
What if Jeb Lewis had an affair with Jeannie Talbert? That little bomb does less to chip away at Kimball's anger than I expect, but I can see fissures beginning to form. He narrows his stare and walks to the table to sit.
I'm not big on town gossip, son. If you have something, you'd better be sure of it.
Toke Talbert had a vasectomy, I say. After my mother got pregnant with me, Toke went apeshit and had a vasectomy. He did it so that no woman could ever try to trap him again.
You have proof of this?
I have my mother's word, but it should be easy enough to verify. I assume you still have Toke's body on ice somewhere. If he couldn't sire another child, then Angel isn't his daughter.
How exactly do you make the leap from that to Jeb having an affair with Jeannie?
They were high school sweethearts. You knew about that, right?
High school was a long time ago.
Jeannie used to work for Bob Mullen. Bob keeps track of calls made from his office. He said that in the months just before Jeannie got pregnant, there were a ton of calls made to one particular number, Jeb's number.
That doesn't prove anything.
No, Sheriff, it doesn't prove anything, but if it's true, that means that one of the investigators in Toke's murder had a motive himself to kill Toke. Kimball swallows hard, and I watch his eyes move back and forth, as though connecting dots in his mind. Then he picks up the phone and hits three numbers.
Shirley, is Jeb still out on that domestic?
Pause.
Is Nathan in the office?
Pause.
Have Nathan join me in the interview room and tell him to bring the Talbert case with him, please.
Kimball rubs the stubble on his chin and lets out a heavy sigh as we wait. The door opens, and Deputy Calder walks in carrying a box, putting it on a chair beside Kimball. Kimball pulls a folder from the box and starts thumbing through it.
Nathan, I have a question to ask you, and I need the absolute truth. I know you and Jeb are close, but this is important.
Calder eases into a chair next to Kimball.
Nathan, do you know anything about Jeb having an affair with Jeannie Talbert?
Calder turns a dark shade of pink when he hears the question. He looks at me, and then back at Kimball, his jaw slackened, his eyes probably trying to read our faces, hoping to find some hint of explanation.
I'm not sure.
Kimball looks up from the file.
What do you mean you're not sure?
Kimball says.
Either you know something or you don't. It was a long time ago. I remember there was a span of a few months when Jeb was asking me to cover for him. You know, pick up a call here and there, not ask questions. I don't know how to explain it exactly. It just seems strange. I thought,
maybe,
you know, but I never knew for sure.
Kimball shakes his head.
Well, shit.
He pulls a second file folder from the box, and I can see that it is the autopsy report. He starts flipping through it.
What's this all about?
Nathan asks.
Little Toke here thinks he has proof that Jeb and Jeannie were having an affair. So what?
Nathan asks.
What's that got to do with the price of tea?
Kimball ignores Calder and continues reading the report.
This strange activity you noticed, would that have been around the time just before Jeannie got pregnant?
Nathan straightens up.
I don't remember. It was a long time ago. Like I said,
Kimball holds up a finger to stop Nathan, his attention aimed at the file in his hand. Kimball goes back to the previous file, which I can now see has Angel's name on the lip. He picks up the phone and pushes three buttons again.
Shirley, could you dig up Jeannie Talbert's suicide file and bring it here?
What is it, Sheriff? Nathan asks.
Probably nothing, but we may have a problem. You see, Little Toke also—
Don't call me that, I say. My name is Joe. My tone yanks Kimball's attention away from his reading, but only for a moment. Then he shrugs and returns to his thought.
Joe has reason to believe that Toke had a vasectomy.
Kimball waits for Nathan to see the link.
Toke might not be Angel's father. You think Jeb might be?
Nathan says. I ask Nathan, how many times has Jeb gone to Mankato to visit Angel?
That's none of your business. How many?
Kimball repeats. Nathan looks humble when he answers.
About every other day. Does his wife know that?
Kimball asks.
He told me to keep it between us.
The receptionist walks in, hands a file to Kimball, and leaves.
I say, does that sound like the actions of a concerned deputy or a concerned father? Oh, Jesus Christ,
Kimball blurts out. He has a look on his face like a man who just caught his son shooting heroin. He throws Jeannie's suicide file onto the table.
What is it?
Nathan asks.
Toke Talbert's blood type is O negative. Jeannie was B.
He looks at Nathan.
According to Angel's medical report, she's AB.
Nathan doesn't respond.
Damn it, Nathan, they lectured about this at the blood seminar we went to last year. Weren't you paying attention?
Nathan shrugs his confusion.
An O and a B cannot give birth to anything with an A in it.
Kimball looks defeated as he speaks.
Toke can't be Angel's father. It's medically impossible. And do you think that Jeb...
Nathan starts. Kimball props his elbows on the table and raises his hands to massage his temples.
Let's look at this and assume two things. First, that Moody is telling the truth, and second, that Jeb knows or at least suspects that he is Angel's father. Jeb arrives at the barn and sees Angel, unconscious, lying next to Toke. Question one, is Toke dead or alive at this point?
Nathan says,
I say he's already dead. If that's so, then Jeb could have easily drawn the conclusion that a girl who just might be his daughter committed murder and then attempted suicide. To protect her, he carries her into the house to throw us off her trail.
I say, but according to Moody, he only hit Toke one time, and Toke was alive when the first car arrived. The autopsy report says that Toke got hit three times. Who struck the second and third blows? Kimball looks up, his face almost gray as he contemplates this worst-case scenario.
Jeb doesn't want Toke to wake up and implicate Angels, so he has to silence Toke.
That's crazy, Calder says. Do you hear yourself, Sheriff? This is Jeb we're talking about. Damn it, you know Jeb. You know he'd never kill anyone, not in a million years.
I'm not saying Jeb killed Toke,
Kimball says.
I'm just saying that if any of this is even close to true, we're in deep shit. A man who could be a suspect is hip deep in the investigation. We need to bring him in and question him.
Are you the right guys for that job? I ask.
What are you implying?
Calder says.
I'm not implying anything. I'm telling you outright. You need to call the BCA down here. You're too close to this.
We can handle it,
Kimball says.
We'll bring him in and get his version. If it looks like you might be right about this, then we're off the case. But we'll be the ones having the conversation with Jeb. In the meantime, this goes nowhere.
Kimball points his finger at me.
This is confidential stuff. We don't want it leaking out. Am I clear?
I nod my agreement, despite my doubts. Chapter 42. I walk back to Bob's office and sit on the hood of my car to await his return. My ribs still hurt, but the four ibuprofens I took earlier have knocked the pain down to a dull throb. The excitement that coursed through my veins when I told Kimball about the affair is replaced with a vague melancholy. It might be residue from Lila's words, or maybe I'm sad to think that Jeb is somehow involved with Toke's death. I like Jeb, and a part of me is hoping that somewhere buried in that file Bob is getting will find the proof that I'm wrong. Behind me in the distance, I hear the rev of a motorcycle engine, and I don't have to turn around to know that it's Vicky. I'm sitting with my elbows resting on my knees, my chest curved to ease the pressure on my ribs. I cast a very small shadow as the sun climbs toward noon, and I hold that pose as she rides by, hoping that I might go unnoticed. It doesn't work. Vicky turns her Triumph around, rides back, and parks on the street beside me, killing her engine.
Hi, stranger.
Hi. I feel like I should be cold to her, but my situation isn't her fault.
So how bad was it?
She asks. Pretty bad, I say.
She break up with you?
I'm not sure.
Not sure?
We're taking some time off, I guess. I look at Vicky. Her cheeks are rosy from the wind, and she is sporting a half-smile, something that gives her face a hopeful appearance.
Does that mean that I could, you know, stop by later?
I hang my head back down and look at the pavement. That's not a good idea.
I see.
I really love my girlfriend, I say. I guess I should have made that clear.
You could have started by telling me that you had a girlfriend at all.
There is no spite in her voice. It almost sounds as if she's apologizing, and that makes me feel even worse. I'm sorry, I say.
Yeah, me too.
It is a wistful statement, one that sounds very much like a final goodbye. She starts her motorcycle, U-turns, and rides away. I try to immerse myself back into thoughts of Jeb and Toke, but all I get are flashes of Lila sitting on our bed, telling me to leave. The bar exam starts tomorrow morning. When it's done, there will be a reckoning, and that thought scares me. I expect Bob to be back by now, but the minutes trudge by with the sluggish gait of a wounded soldier. An hour passes, and I'm about to walk to the courthouse to check on him when Bob turns the corner with an accordion folder in his hands, waving me to follow him into his office. He looks winded from his walk.
I was getting worried, I say.
I stopped by the sheriff's office to see how they were taking the news about Jeb.
And?
They're throwing a conniption over there. I could hear Kimball yelling to beat all hell. Then they walked by with Jeb in handcuffs, taking him to jail.
Jeb confessed?
Kimball told me that Jeb admitted to taking Angel into the house. That's as far as I got. Jeb must have figured out that he was in a heap of trouble because he invoked his right to remain silent.
But they arrested him for Toke's murder?
Not yet. They have him for interfering with a murder scene. It's not a felony, but they can hold him overnight while they try to figure out what happened.
Moody was telling the truth.
Kimball's recommending that Moody be released. The complaint they have is wrong, and they know it.
Bob put the Lynch file down on Jeannie's desk.
I'm going back over to the jail. I want to tell Moody the good news.
Would you mind if I took a look through the file? I ask.
Bob considers this for a few seconds and says,
Sure. Just do me a favor and don't snoop around the office while I'm gone.
Wouldn't dream of it, I say. Bob is about to leave when he stops and slowly turns to face me, the thoughts in his head pinching his forehead into deep creases.
You know what this means, don't you?
What means?
If Jeb is Angel's father, you see how that changes things.
Sure, it gives Jeb a motive to kill Toke, if that's what you're getting at.
No, that's not what I'm getting at. Jeannie's estate has been fully probated. Everything has been signed and sealed. That estate now belongs to Toke, and Toke alone.
I don't see where he's going with this.
If Toke is not Angel's father, then by the laws of intestacy, she can't inherit. The estate is Toke's, and every bit of it goes to his sole heir. The one person who can prove that he is Toke's biological son.
Bob points his finger at me.
That's not... I had no idea.
Angel gets nothing.
But she's Jeannie's daughter.
I suppose Angel's guardian could bring a petition to reopen the case, split the inheritance between Angel and Toke. But right now she has no guardian.
That's what should happen, I say.
You say that now, but I've been doing this a long time. It's easy to sound noble when the money is theoretical. It's a different matter when the money becomes real. You'll start thinking that $6 million sounds a whole lot better than $3 million. I've seen it happen.
24 hours ago, I'd been certain that Bob was wrong about me. After last night, though, I'm not sure of anything. I won't change my mind, I say. But even as I say the words, I see myself standing where Vicky took me to show me the fields. I shake that image away and say again, I won't change my mind. I promise. Bob says,
No offense, Joe. But I'll believe that when I see it.
With those parting words, he heads out the door. Chapter 43. Bob's office is quiet after he leaves. I spread the Moody Lynch file out on Jeannie's desk. The accordion folder holds four sets of papers clamped together with big, black binding clips. There's also a large manila envelope with the word Recordings written on it. I open the envelope and let the CDs slide onto the desk. At the top of the heap is Nathan's squad video. I figured that would be a good place to start. It takes me a minute to fire up Jeannie's computer and another two or three to launch the squad video. When it opens, the computer screen divides into five boxes, a big box on the left and four smaller boxes stacked on the right. The bigger box is obviously the forward-facing squad camera. One of the smaller squares is a camera pointing into the back seat of the squad car. After some study, I figure out that the other three are views of the sides and rear of the car. At the start of the video, Nathan's squad is speeding down a country highway, thin reflections of the emergency lights bouncing off the car's hood. I hear dispatch inform Nathan that 2804 is near the scene and is responding off-duty. I look through some reports to confirm that 2804 is Jeb's badge number. Nathan replies, 10-4. His voice is calm as a man reading a newspaper. I watch for 15 minutes before I see something I recognize. The bridge where Vicky's mother died. I know now that Nathan is almost at the scene. He slows as he gets to the farm, and I lean forward to examine every second of footage carefully. Through the front windshield, the world rotates as Nathan pulls into the courtyard and parks facing the house, a dim glow falling from one of the windows on the second floor. To the right of the squad car is the horse barn, its door open, light spilling out into the courtyard. The squad camera facing left shows Jeb's personal vehicle, the one he drove on our trip to Mankato. Nathan gets out of his squad car and walks to the barn, enters, and bends down over a black lump lying just inside the door. Then he stands up, walks to the door of the barn, and keys his shoulder microphone.
Dispatch, we have a 10. A 10. Aw, hell. Marlene. We have a homicide here. Better send an ambulance and the coroner. Wake Sheriff Kimball up, too.
Dispatch responded. 10-4, be advised that 2804 called. He is in the house with a medical.
10-4.
Nathan starts running toward the house but stops to look at the highway. Something caught his attention. I click on the rearview camera, and out of the back of Nathan's squad, I see Vicky sitting on her motorcycle. I can hear her muffled voice as she yells something to Nathan. Nathan hollers back.
It's police business. Go on up to your house and stay put.
Vicky pulls her motorcycle into her driveway, and I watch the red brake lights reflect off the white pole barn as she goes to park it. Nathan jogs to the house, disappearing inside. Nothing happens for a few seconds, but then Ray Pike's porch light comes on. Vicky and her father step out and walk down to a split rail fence that separates their lawn from the highway. There they take up a position to watch the action. A few minutes later, Nathan walks out of the house, heading for the barn. As he approaches the black lump again, I realize that the lump is Toke. I can only see his legs because of the angle of the squad at the barn door. For the next 15 minutes, I watch the flash of emergency lights reflect off the house and the barn and the trees, waiting for something to happen. Vicky and her dad are like statues in the strobe of those lights, their images appearing and disappearing as the red bulb pulses on top of the squad car. Then the cavalry arrives. First, Sheriff Kimball pulls in, followed closely by an ambulance. Nathan directs the EMTs to the house. They enter, and a minute later, one returns to the ambulance to grab a gurney. When they wheel Angel out of the house, Jeb is at her side, holding her hand. They load Angel into the back of the ambulance and leave, with Jeb following in his Explorer. Things slow down after that, with more squads showing up and more cops milling around the courtyard with flashlights, probably looking for trace evidence. About 40 minutes into the footage, a car pulls in, and a woman gets out and walks into the barn. I assume that this is the coroner, there to certify the death of Toke Talbert. Then a second ambulance arrives, the one that will haul Toke Talbert off the property in a body bag. I watch as that ambulance leaves the courtyard, its lights off. No emergency. It rolls past Vicky and Ray, who are still leaning up against the split rail fence, and I wonder if Ray might not be silently happy to see Toke zipped in that body bag. But then again, did he even know what was in the bag? That thought is but a fleeting curiosity, and is about to leave my head forever when it digs in and demands my attention. I pause the CD. Something's not right here. Something terribly important is missing. I start the footage from the beginning and watch again, this time focusing on the rear camera. I see Vicky pull up on her motorcycle, talk to Nathan, and then go park her bike in the shed. I slow the footage down, moving it forward frame by frame. When I do that, I glimpse her silhouette walking from the pole barn to her house. I can only see it in a couple of the frames, when the cast of red light from Nathan's strobe flashes that way. Then she and her father walk down to the fence and stand there for the rest of the video. As I'm watching it the second time, I think about the trip she and I took to the Hicks farm on my first day in town. The day Vicky showed me the bloodstain on the barn wall. What did she say? She said that Toke was up against the wall, lying on his stomach. But in the video, Vicky is across the road with her father the whole time. It's not possible for her to see Toke's body from there. How did she know he was on his stomach? I had seen the autopsy photos. She hadn't. She knew that his head had been bashed in. She knew where he fell and how he had lain, yet she never left her fence until after Toke was hauled away. There had to be an explanation. Maybe someone had told her what the scene looked like. Jeb? Another cop, maybe? Or maybe her father killed Toke, and he told her how Toke had fallen. That made some sense. He hated Toke Talbert, blamed Toke for the death of his wife. Toke had just executed the option contract that would take the final section of Ray's farm away. I back the footage to the beginning for a third run. This time, I focus on the side and rear cameras when Nathan drives up to the farm. As Nathan passes Ray's house and starts to pull into the courtyard, I pause the CD and begin clicking forward one frame at a time. Nathan pulls into the courtyard, parks. The other camera angles pull at my attention, but I keep my eyes locked on that rear view. Click, click, click. I'm watching Ray's house for any movement at all. Click, click. Then I see it. Something so hidden that I wouldn't have spotted it unless I was looking for it. I enlarge the picture, zeroing in on a small patch of space beside Ray's house. The truth was there the whole time, hidden in the darkness but caught in a single flash of a red light. I drop my head and mutter, "Son of a bitch." Chapter 44. With the sun slouching just above the western horizon, I find myself pulling into the courtyard of the Hicks farm, on a quest to view in the daylight what I had seen in the darkness of Nathan's squad video. I cross the road and stand where Vicky and Ray stood as they watched the happenings on the night that Toke died. I am right. There is no way that Vicky could have seen Toke inside the barn from her position at the fence. I turn and face Ray's house. There's a tree line to my left, and the house is dead ahead of me. But between the house and the trees lies a small patch of lawn about 40 feet wide, where Nathan's camera caught the image of someone running toward the little house. I'm leaning against the fence, calibrating the picture in my mind, when Vicky steps out of the house. I expect her to walk down and join me, but instead, she sits on her porch steps. "I'm kind of surprised to see you," she calls out. "I thought I'd take another look at the farm." I walk up to the house, scanning the windows for any sign of Ray. When I am within a few feet, I stop. "Besides, I wanted to talk to you." "You came all this way to see little old me?" She scoots over, making room for me to sit beside her on the porch steps. I hesitate, but then I sit. "Did you hear that they arrested Jeb Lewis?" I ask.
"They did what?"
"This morning."
"Why?"
"What I hear is that they charged him with altering the crime scene, but they are holding him because they think he might have killed Toke.
Why would Jeb kill Toke?
You haven't heard?
No. Heard what?
Jeb might be Angel's biological father. Vicky's jaw drops open, but she remains mute.
It's true. Jeb and Jeannie had an affair.
Kimball thinks it's the key to what happened to Toke.
That doesn't make sense. I can't see Jeb killing anyone.
If he's willing to break the law, why stop with altering the crime scene?
There's a world of difference between altering a crime scene and killing a man, she says. I mean, sure, if Angel's his kid, then maybe I could see him moving her, but killing Toke in the process? That's a bridge too far. Now, that Charlie character's a whole different story. I could see him.
She stops talking because I've dropped my head, and I'm shaking it slowly back and forth.
What?
She asks. Vicky, I know what you did. I don't say it as an accusation, but as a confession, my voice barely rising above a whisper.
What are you talking about?
I know that it was you who killed Toke.
Are you insane? I didn't kill Toke. Why would I do a fool thing like that?
For starters, he killed your mom.
Good God, that was a decade ago. You think that I would wait this long to—
He was going to execute the contract and take away the last section of your dad's farm. Vicky looks at me with surprise and quickly turns her focus to the ground in front of her. Yeah, I know about that, I say.
I didn't kill him, she says. I wasn't even here when he was killed.
Then how did you know that Jeb carried Angel to the house?
What?
You just said that you could understand Jeb moving Angel if she were his kid. How did you know that Jeb moved Angel?
You just told me he did.
No, I told you that Jeb altered the scene. I didn't say how. You were the one to say that Jeb moved Angel. I keep my words calm. Explanations. Not accusations. You couldn't have known that if you hadn't been here to see it.
I must have heard it somewhere.
She shrugs her shoulders up around her neck.
You know how gossip gets around this town.
Gossip? I say. No one knew about Jeb moving Angel. The sheriff only learned about it when they arrested Jeb a few hours ago. You didn't even know Jeb was in custody. So your source of information isn't gossip.
What are you getting at?
She looks at me again, and I can see a hint of fear in her eyes. And how did you know that Toke was lying dead on his stomach?
Lying on his stomach?
When you took me to the barn that first day, you said that Toke was lying on his stomach, up against the wall.
I saw it when—
She stops herself.
Why are you doing this?
Because I know the truth.
You don't know anything.
Nathan saw me come home after Toke was already dead.
It's probably on his squad camera. I couldn't have killed Toke.
It's on the video, that's true. Bob Mullen had a copy in his office and I watched it today.
So, you saw me come home?
Cracks in her voice tell me that she's afraid. I don't want to scare her too much. I want her to keep talking, so I pretend that this next part is hard for me to say. I saw you stop and say something to Nathan Calder. You were on your triumph.
You see? I couldn't have.
She's looking at me now with eyes that implore me to believe her. I feel sorry for her, and I no longer have to pretend that I am sad to be telling her what I know. I say, when Nathan first pulled in, long before you stopped your bike in the middle of the highway to set up your alibi, I saw you. Vicky swallows hard, and her eyes grow with either fear or understanding. You ran from those trees, over there, I point to the windbreak, to the shed where you park your bike. A few seconds later, I saw the reflection of your brake lights against the wall of the shed as you rolled your motorcycle down the trail behind your house.
I don't believe you.
I pull a piece of paper from my back pocket. It's folded so she can't see the picture inside. I hold it between my index and middle finger and lightly tap it against the evening breeze, letting Vicky's curiosity grow until that paper becomes the center of her world. Then, I unfold the photo and hand it to her. The picture of her running across her lawn is grainy and out of focus, but it was the best I could do with the single frame of squad video. Her reaction, a sharp inhale, tells me that she won't try denying that it's her. She curls her shoulders down, and puts her face in her hands, the picture of her guilt falling to the porch steps.
You don't understand, she says.
It's okay, I say, although my words are a lie. Vicky is crying, and I put an arm around her shoulders. She's talking to me, and I don't want that to stop, so I play along. If ever a man on earth deserved what he got, it was Toke.
He called me a bitch, she says between her sobs. I went to the barn to help him. He was barely moving, like he was trying to wake up or something. I bent down to help him, and when he saw me, he called me a bitch. I don't know what happened. I got so mad. He killed my mom, and he was calling me a bitch. I couldn't stop myself. I saw that gear lying there, and...
Behind us, some floorboards creak, and I look over my shoulder to see Ray Pike standing in the doorway, his hair mussed like he'd just gotten up from a nap. He looks at me, and then at Vicky, who is crying in my arms. His face twists up in anger.
What's he doing here? Ray yells.
Startled, Vicky jumps to her feet and backs away from the porch. She's wiping tears from her cheek with the back of her hand as she says,
Dad, he knows.
Shut your mouth, Ray shouts.
He's saying the words to Vicky, but he's pointing his finger at me.
Don't you say another word to this bastard. He ain't your friend.
Daddy, he's...
I said shut up!
Ray charges down the steps and grabs me by the shirt, pulling my face into his. I can smell the whiskey and chewing tobacco on his breath. I expect him to throw me into the wall, but instead, he rips my shirt open. Both he and Vicky are struck dumb when they see the microphone taped to my chest. Chapter 45. The evening air fills with the distant sound of police sirens. Ray throws me to the ground.
Get going,
he hollers, as he turns to run into the house. I'm not sure if he's talking to me or to Vicky. I don't think she knows either, because she doesn't move. He yells again.
Go to where I took you camping when you were a kid. I'll get you help. Now go!
Vicky runs to the pole barn where the tiger is parked. Ray walks out of the house with a shotgun in his hand, but he doesn't aim it at me. In fact, he walks right past me, as if I'm not even there, taking up a position in the middle of his yard. The closest squad car, Nathan's, had been parked behind some trees about a quarter mile away, close enough to monitor the wire. The rest of the troops had been waiting down at the bridge. Nathan is leading the charge, but as he nears the driveway, Ray raises the shotgun and fires, causing Nathan to drive into a ditch. The other three squad cars park on the shoulder behind Calder, creating a defensive wall. Ray keeps the gun aimed at the deputies as Vicky backs her bike out of the shed. Ray is talking to himself, and I hear him say,
No daughter of mine's going to prison for killing Toke Talbert. I'll goddamn guarantee you that. I should have killed the prick years ago.
Vicky looks back at her father one last time, sparks the triumph to life, and tears down the trail behind the house. After Vicky is safely away, Ray lets the gun settle into the crux of his arm, the butt resting in his armpit. He pulls a pack of cigarettes out of his shirt pocket, lifts one to his lips, and lights it. He takes a long drag, and then raises the shotgun back up.
Come on, you cowards, he yells.
He fires again with no noticeable damage to any of the vehicles.
Damn it, Ray, put down the gun.
I recognize Sheriff Kimball's voice calling out from behind one of the vehicles.
Go to hell, Ray shouts back.
The sound of the motorcycle fades into the distance. Ray's impromptu plan is working. His daughter is escaping.
Put the gun down before this gets out of hand, Kimball yells. We don't want anyone getting hurt.
Bring it on, you sons of bitches,
Ray yells. And when he does, he holds his arms out to the side, opening his chest up to be a target. He is standing about 25 feet away from me with his gun in his left hand, the muzzle pointing toward the sky, his finger nowhere near the trigger. I scramble to my feet and charge the big man, hoping that Nathan and the others are watching. I run as fast as I can, my shoulders down. Ray hears me when I'm about 8 feet away and tries to ready his shotgun, but I hit him in the back with all the force I can muster. Pain explodes through my neck, and my bruised rib comes alive with a whole new level of hurt. We tumble forward. I land on top of Ray's back, his arms outstretched in front of him, the gun still clenched tightly in his hand. I roll forward and grab the shotgun, trying to wrestle it away, I start to twist it around to break his grip, but he grabs the stock with his free hand and tries to jerk it back. The gun is facing the sky, so I jam my thumb onto the trigger and the gun explodes, the butt slamming into the ground, the pellets shooting harmlessly skyward. He can't shoot it now without ratcheting another shell. All I have to do is hang on and not let him chamber another round. He's on his knees, and I'm still on my backside, kicking my feet into him and pulling at the gun with everything I have. Pain lights up my chest, and I feel like I'm being bludgeoned with a board full of spikes. Ray has strong fingers and hands, but he's worn out and breathes in chunks. Spittle bubbles from the side of his lip, white and frothy against his dark red cheeks. I pull on the gun, expecting him to yank back and make this a tug of war, but instead, Ray lunges at me, the stock of the gun landing across my throat, his heavy body pinning me to the ground. I can't breathe. I claw at the back of his hands, but he keeps pressing. The light around his face is fading, shrinking, and I'm pretty sure I'm about to pass out. That's when something slams into Ray from the side. I don't know what it is at first, but then I see Nathan Calder clamped onto Ray's back, the two men rolling down the slope of the lawn. I can breathe again, and I gulp at the warm summer air. Tiny dots of light squirm in my vision as my blood pressure settles, and in my hand I am still holding the shotgun. Two other deputies pile on top of Ray, each one grabbing an arm and prying them behind his back. Nathan is scooted out from under the big man and is reaching for a pair of handcuffs.
Quit squirming, Ray, or I'll have to tase you,
Nathan yells.
Fuck you, Nathan.
Ray twists back and forth, unable to shake free of the three-piece officers. Nathan clinks the handcuffs around one wrist, then the other.
Where's Vicky?
Sheriff Kimball asks as he lumbers up the driveway, a latecomer to the party.
She took off on her motorcycle, I say, pointing past the house.
Kimball looks in the direction of the pole barn, grits his teeth, and curses under his breath. Then he turns to the two deputies whose names I don't know and says,
Get in your squads. Tank, you head east, and John, you go west. Keep an ear out for that bike of hers.
You ain't never gonna find her,
Ray growls between gasps of air.
Shut up, Ray,
Nathan says, taking a knee beside him like a hunter posing next to his trophy.
No one's asking you.
Kimball walks over, and together he and Nathan lift Ray to his feet.
I'll take Ray in, Kimball says. You go help with the search.
Nathan and Kimball each take an arm and walk Ray Pike to Kimball's car, while I remain sitting in the yard alone. I guess I expect a thank you or something, but they completely ignore me. After Sheriff Kimball drives away, Nathan stays behind, inspecting his car for damage from the shotgun blasts. I peel off the tape that held the wire and battery pack to my body and walk down to hand the transmitter to Calder.
I told you she'd confess, I say. You heard her, right?
He tosses the gear into his squad car but doesn't answer. He's mad, and I think it's because it was my idea to wear the wire. I'm the one who cracked the case. I'm the one who saw the female cutting across Ray's lawn and the glow of the Triumph's taillight against the shed. I'm the one who figured out that Vicky had been to the barn before Nathan got there. And when I showed Kimball and Calder what I'd found, Nathan couldn't wait to criticize it.
It's too blurry, he said. And even if that's her, that doesn't mean she killed Toke. I guarantee you that a good defense lawyer will come up with a reasonable explanation as to why she's running through that gap.
Let me wear a wire, I said. I can get her to talk. I know I can. Nathan had been flatly against it, but I convinced Kimball. I would go in first, get her talking, try to get her tangled up before they charged in and arrested her. If she later invoked her right to remain silent, they'd have my conversation to take to court. It was a simple plan. What could go wrong? I had said. Now, I knew what could go wrong. You got her confession on tape, didn't you? I say again.
You should go, Nathan says.
Why are you such a dick?
I say. What did I ever do to you?
Nathan stops inspecting his car and turns to look at me with dead eyes.
I had to call Jeb Lewis's wife today and tell her that we were arresting him. I had to tell her about Jeb's affair with Jeannie. She went to pieces. You have any idea what that's like? Delivering that kind of news? Jeb has two girls. His life's in shambles right now, and all because of you.
Nathan looks at the road between us, shaking his head like he has more to say, but is holding it back.
Go home, he says, You've done enough damage.
Chapter 46. I don't go home because I have no home to go to. I spend the rest of the evening alone at the Caspian Inn, Nathan Calder's words echoing off the walls around me. I had exposed Jeb's affair, broke up his family, and got him arrested. All for nothing. Vicky Pike, my father's murderer, was now on the run. I should have hated Vicky for what she did, but I couldn't seem to muster that emotion. She had killed a man who wanted me to die in my mother's womb. He was a first-rate asshole. Ask anyone. And now, because of some bizarre chain of events,